Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
Look what happened. Is this crazy? But it's a political victory that our country has never seen before, nothing like this. I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president. This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
America elects Donald Trump for the second time and now makes a sharp course correction.
Many people have told me that God spared my life for a reason. And that reason was to save our country and to restore America to greatness. And now we are going to fulfill that mission together. It's time to put the divisions of the past 4 years behind us. It's time to unite. And we're going to try. We're going to try. We have to try. And we are going to start by all putting America first. We have to put our country first for at least a period of time. We have to fix it. Because together we can truly make America great again for all Americans. So I want to just tell you what a great honor this is. I want to thank you. I will not let you down. America's future will be bigger, better, bolder, richer, safer, and stronger than it has ever been before.
Late last night, Wisconsin put Trump over the top in the count of electoral votes, 277 to Harris's 224, with only 270 electoral votes needed to win. Republicans also take the Senate for the first time, at least for the moment, until California's votes are completely counted. Trump has won the popular vote, which means a majority of Americans want the nation to chart a new course. Voters decided they want a strong man, and the result could not just reshape America's domestic politics, but also global alliances, and quite literally create a new world order. This hour, we take some baby steps in exploring what the voters said yesterday and combing through some of the other decisions voters made that affect us here in North Carolina. And we'll do that with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Dr. Susan Roberts joins us. She's a professor of political science at Davidson College. And we're also joined by the first time by Dr. Candace Watt-Smith, professor of political science at Duke University. Welcome to you all. Candace,
good morning.
Good morning. Since you're the newcomer here, Candace, to what do you attribute this win?
Ooh, okay. Well, if that's how you welcome newcomers, let's go. I have to say that I think that it's important for us to remember how we got to this moment with Harris at the helm of the Democratic Party in the first place. That Biden, you know, in 2020 implied that he would just be a transition candidate, a transition president to get us through. And he didn't step down when he needed to. And, you know, people were not hopeful of the Democratic Party. I know that there was an incredible surge of enthusiasm upon his stepping down. But I do think the fact that there wasn't a Democratic primary, that, you know, Kamala Harris ran a couple of months of a campaign, and that people were worried about the economy and felt that the former president, Donald Trump, would do the work of improving the economy in a way that this kind of new candidate wasn't tested and had no evidence that she could do so.
Susan, both candidates, both parties, many pundits all said that this election was the most important presidential election in our lifetimes, perhaps since the Civil War. I suppose we'll find out whether that's true or not in the coming months, but was it, in your opinion?
Well, I think Donald Trump told us that it was going to be. I mean, I think if you looked at people were evaluating Kamala Harris about what are you going to do? What are your policies? Donald Trump had told through tangentially through Project 2025, but also Agenda 47, which was very similar. That was Trump's agenda from the Republican convention. Trump told us that it was a very important decision. I think he said, I'm going to be a dictator the first day, and really campaigned by hyperbole. And the messages just weren't the same. I think that this one was looked on as the point in which the guardrails were off. If you put it in the context of questions about access to abortion, the Supreme Court making the president, not very vulnerable to any charges about what he or she might do in office, I think the stakes were very high. I think Americans did realize that, but I think that they really didn't think that Kamala Harris could govern. They were fearful of Trump, but in the end, they just simply chose the economy. I don't think it was a matter of campaigning. Everybody said that Harris ran a flawless campaign. No matter how long she'd been, it was a very disciplined campaign.
So I'm going to come back to the economy over democracy, because that's apparently what we have done here in the last 24 hours. The Harris campaign, Steve, was hoping that the blue wall would hold. It did not. They were hoping that they would have a victory in Georgia and in North Carolina. They did not. What role did North Carolina play in the outcome of this election?
It ultimately wasn't decisive, but it was a very clear indicator early on. I mean, Mike, you and I were in the studio last night looking at the early returns coming in, and you could see this rightward shift all across the state. When counties started reporting their results, it happened in rural counties, it happened in urban counties. So North Carolina was this early sign that that things were going very well for the former president. And, you know, I just want to say, I think some of the warning signs were here, not just in the polls. When you look at North Carolina, things like over the last 4 years, like party registration, Democrats were just losing tens of thousands of members. And they believed that they were going to make up for that with unaffiliated voters. Republicans, people were signing up to register as Republicans. There was just clear signs that Democrats had a real problem in North Carolina and other states. And then, of course, when early voting started, we saw this tremendous surge of interest among Republicans to get out and vote early. So I think that a lot of the, if you read the tea leaves, they were showing a lot of Republican strength.
Candace, the Democrats have to take a close look at themselves now, because clearly they have lost a big part of their coalition. They're not communicating well with people that they probably should have gotten. They certainly thought they would get. What's the problem with Democrats? Is it messaging? Is it the shift in candidates? Is it the fact that for the longest time they kind of, I don't want to use the word hid, because I don't know that they hid Joe Biden, but they refused to acknowledge that perhaps Biden should not run again, and she came late to the race. What's the deal here?
I think it's all of those things. The Democratic Party historically has been the party that says that, you know, we care about the people, we're listening to what people need, we want to make sure that people have the things that they need. I think that the Democratic Party has become a little lazy. There was a last minute kind of conversation about Black men. And I think that, you know, some of that was indicative of the idea that, you know, Democrats believe that they could depend on certain groups, and that, I think a lot of the groups that have kind of shifted are signaling that they want to have choices and that they want parties to fight for their votes.
Let me flip the coin. What did Republicans offer these people who decided they were going to walk away from Democrats?
Sure. I think one is that, saying that they would, you know, say, the economy, I think, is a very complicated thing and people tend toward easy solutions. But to say we're going to do something different, Kamala Harris couldn't say that. I mean, the thing is that the economy has improved. It's a hard thing to say, I'm going to do something different than what's working. But, you know, there's reality and there's perception, and perception matters a lot.
Susan, we have all these coalitions that the Democrats have depended on historically, African-Americans, Hispanics or Latinos, and women, particularly in this race, since they were fielding a female candidate of mixed race. Yesterday, 152 years ago yesterday, Susan B. Anthony broke the law. She voted in an election in which women were not allowed to vote. 2 weeks later, she was arrested. She demanded to be handcuffed by police as they hauled her away, just as a man would. She was tried, she was convicted, and she was fined. But yesterday, 152 years later, women came to the polls in record numbers with a woman on the ballot and voted for Donald Trump. Talk about that.
Well, I think that one of the things about the economy, yes, is abstract, and I want to get back to it, but Kamala Harris was talking about protecting democracy, and, the economy was the leading issue. It's very abstract to talk about protecting democracy. What does that mean? Keeping out fraud in elections or trying to make our freedoms and keep the presidency kind of in check and three branches. But I think the women's vote really did respond in many areas. It was not the simple access to abortion that some people thought, nor was it the rhetoric that Trump unleashed. And there's no two ways about it that J.D. Vance calling Kamala Harris trash or some of the other slurs that Donald Trump issued about Nancy Pelosi. But I don't know, you know, in their heart of hearts, were women looking at the pocketbook issues? Because it doesn't matter when you say the economy's doing better, it's not as abstract as democracy. And his was his campaign. Maybe campaigns mattered, but I think it was a very simple pocketbook issue and not the issue of the economy writ large. It was the issue of the pocketbook. The women's vote, just like Candace said, Black voters have been saying, don't just look at us one day a year, look at us 365 days a year. Empower the Black voters, which is some of the issues that Black voters matter, some of the things that Stacey Abrams was doing, some other places, organizations. Maybe we are taking certain slices. And I think one warning sign was the issue and the question of young Black males. And even at the end, early voting has its benefits, but would do Hispanic Latina voters have buyer's remorse? I mean, did they vote early and vote for Trump and wish that they could somehow take that back, given the Puerto Rican comments and such?
I was just going to jump in. I mean, I think the idea of the buyer's remorse, Trump over the last 8 years has said so many things that in theory would give Latino voters buyer's remorse. I mean, this wasn't out of the blue, and yet they still went and cast ballots for him in record numbers.
So when we come back, I want to talk about the role of early voting, because we had record early voting not only in North Carolina, but in many places around the country. And I think around the country, when you take it as a total, early voting was set records. I don't know what yesterday's voting turnout was. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the role that women played in North Carolina in the outcome here. When we come back, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Candace Watt-Smith is a professor of political science at Duke University. And Susan Roberts is professor of political science at Davidson College. We had record early voting turnout in many places around the country. I think overall it was record. I think the same is true of North Carolina. What was yesterday like in terms of voting turnout in North Carolina, Steve? And what role did women play in this election in North Carolina?
So turnout 4 years ago was a remarkable 75%. Yesterday, it was a little lower at 72%. And early voting, it was interesting. Early in-person voting was ahead, in 2024 was ahead of 2020. But when you combine the mail ballots, you know, mail to mail and early in person to the two elections, it was down a little bit this year. So I think there was some signs that turnout might be a little lower. And if you kind of just drove around yesterday, there weren't many people at the polls. There weren't many people left to vote, but there also just weren't many people out and about.
How did Mecklenburg County do? Because we always have lower voter turnout than other urban areas in the state.
And that is once again true. I believe I'm looking, our turnout this year was 65%. And so let's see, no, 69%. I'm sorry. So a 4-point drop from the state turnout. And that's been consistent.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you compare that to Wake County, which is the largest, most populated county in the state?
I can pull that up in about 2 seconds. But I know all through early voting, Wake was running higher than Meck.
Does anybody understand why Mecklenburg is historically low in terms of voter participation?
I mean, my theory, I think it's a lot of things. I think we're really detached from state politics is one part of it. We're just tucked down here in the corner, 3 hours away from Raleigh, and politics isn't a sport like it is in the Triangle. I think that's part of it. I think we are a much more diverse and international community than anywhere else in North Carolina. I think we have more people who are foreign born, who are just slower getting locked into the American system, I think. I mean, I just think that's part of it. I think there's a whole lot of reasons, but it turns up year in and year out.
This is an election that people will write about if they're allowed to for years to come. Because the economy was a key issue in this. And I think that's what voters said yesterday, if I'm hearing all of you correctly. They voted with their pocketbook, with their own personal economies at the forefront, despite the fact that The Economist says the U.S. economy is the envy of the world. The stock market has been soaring in the last couple of years. Employment is high. Unemployment is low. Wages are up. Yes, inflation was bad coming out of the pandemic, largely because of the things that were done to bring us out of the pandemic and to avoid a terrible recession. But that led to higher prices, which are now beginning to stabilize, but they will never come down because nobody wants deflation. So the economy was the big deal. But the other big deal was this talk about a Trump victory, meaning the end of democracy. He has, after all, promised to be a dictator on day one. He does admire strong men around the world. He intends to surround himself with loyalists. He intends to populate the civil service, something that's never been done before, with loyalists. It's all laid out in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 document. Candace and Susan, where do you see this going? Will he live out Democrats' worst fears? Or will he be prevented by a House, if the Democrats take a House, that have the nation's best interest in mind in their opinions? Will he be thwarted or will he just run roughshod? I'll start with you, Candace.
Well, I think, the way that the House moves is going to be really important. But it's really important to keep in mind that, you know, the Senate is the one that, judicial candidates have to run through, that that just kind of norms around civility and expectations to concede if you lose. You know, there's all these sorts of things that are going to go out of the window. We are in a new kind of.
Well, yes, and he has the Senate. The Republicans have the Senate, which means that all of his nominations are likely to pass, and that includes judicial nominees, and there are likely to be two, at least two, or maybe one at least two, appointments to the Supreme Court that might come up in the next 4 years. People have already complained about the politicization of the Supreme Court and its rightward shift, which is out of step, people say, with much of the country, and he can make it even more so. Susan, is that likely to happen?
Sure. And I think that people talk about, I teach Congress, that the Senate is the place where good bills go to die. There's no reason to expect that that will change. And I think we lost a lot of probably Casey and John Tester. There's a lot of institutional memory that was lost in the U.S. Senate. And I think that Trump tried that. He said, I'm going to be nice. I'm going to be nice. And it lasted when he was campaigning for all of, like, you know, 20 minutes into a campaign speech. I think one thing that will increase, and it's very disappointing, is partisan antipathy will increase. It will be very difficult to bring a return to civility. And I think that if we look at some things about the context of American democracy, there's one silver lining. And that is, at least the way the election came out, there may be social unrest, but it will not be one that takes to the streets. They will no longer, at least immediately, there will no longer be accusations of disinformation, of fake news, of fraud. That will be at bay at least a little bit. It won't be there today, but I listened to Trump's speech, and it's about America first. And for some people, that was something that was problematic for the left, liberals, Democrats. So I think it's very different. I don't see, besides just the context of disinformation, accusations of voter fraud, that there is a lot to be optimistic about. He has that agenda. He has people in place to implement that agenda. And it was just not even a legal fiction, that he wasn't aware of Project 2025. We just got to be realistic about that. And he has some very smart people who can implement that immediately.
Is this what America wants? Is this what voters said yes to yesterday, Steve? Or were they really voting with their pocketbooks? Do they want, because he has promised to end the war in Ukraine on the first day, in one day, which means he will give it over to Putin. He'll stop sending arms to Ukraine. There was a big push at the end to talk about the end of these endless wars. We don't have any wars going in America that we are causing. So is this what American voters bargained for?
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying that Ukraine was top of mind for anyone or even a top 10 issue for anyone. But, right, I mean, everyone went in, you know, clear eyes, knowing what President Trump wanted to do.
Do Americans understand what a complete fundamental realignment of our alliances around the world is going to mean if he follows through on that?
I think they looked back at his first term and they assessed what America was like in 2016 and what it was like in 2020, and we're okay with that. I mean, you know, we've had a pretty large sample size of Trump. We've had 4 years of him in office, 4 years of him running to get the office back. I don't think we could plead ignorance. I think everyone's pretty well aware. And then, of course, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, $1 billion spent on ads to try and disqualify him. So I think people pulled the lever for him, knowing, comfortable with what he was promising.
We have people who worked with him in the past, high-ranking generals and others in the White House, who said he is a danger to the country, a danger to the world. He leaks classified information. Our allies are going to be reluctant to trade information because they don't want it to leak like a sieve, because people's lives are at stake. He has advocated in the past, at least, sidling up to dictators and away from traditional alliances that have kept the world at peace, since World War II. Did Americans think about this, Candace? I mean, is this if he goes through with this, what does the world look like?
I don't think that we have evidence that the average American can connect dots between what the president's role is in the economy and what it isn't.
Why not?
We have half of the country that has voted for a person who is willing to etch out the Department of Education. And I don't think that people know what that means either. So what I'm saying here is when we ask Americans how the government works, what are the three branches of government, who sits on the Supreme Court, these kind of basic questions, we know that we're not getting the right answers. And so to ask people to what we are hoping is that people see that, yes, you voted for a person when the economy was good. You voted for that same person, not recognizing that when Donald Trump says, I'm going to end inflation, that is not something that he can do single-handedly. And I don't think that the average person knows that that is just not true.
Susan, when there are shootings in America, at these mass shootings, people always come to the forefront and they say, well, this is not who we are. Clearly it is, because we keep having these shootings. And there are other examples of that. And yesterday, half of America, a little over half of America, voted for Donald Trump, a man who has spewed invective and talks about revenge and talks about fundamentally changing the nature of the country in terms of how our government works and our democracy works. And people say, well, that's not who we are. Well, clearly it is who we are, because 52% at least of Americans said that's the guy we want. So what do we have to admit to ourselves about who we are today?
Well, that's a tough one. I think we need to look beyond saying that Americans can look to leaders in the Republican Party that have, you know, very not even just disenchanted with Donald Trump. That didn't sell. And I think that if I had to go back and say one kernel, there was no cult following for Kamala Harris. There remained a kind of cult following, meaning the base vote, that they didn't mind the rhetoric and they're going to support Trump. And I think the other part, kind of the people, the Republicans that are going to vote more or did vote more on the economy, they felt like they just didn't see the leadership in Kamala Harris. And if you look in North Carolina, abortion was number four. And when we talk about what Trump has done for, or you know, questionable for Hispanics and other immigrants, that just wasn't at the top of the issue for the Hispanic vote. And so I really think, Mike, that this is going to be something that people, there's been, you know, a concerted attempt to discredit expertise and to discredit scientists. And I think that persisted in the mode of, you know, people that were in this Trump administration.
Well, last night he acknowledged Robert F. Kennedy's role in this, and he's going to put Robert F. Kennedy in charge of health, I think, or he says he is. Yeah. Then we have Elon Musk, who's an oligarch. He's going to put him in charge of something. Around the country, Steve, and here in North Carolina, people would go to the polls yesterday, and they voted in some states to have looser abortion laws. In those same states, those voters chose Donald Trump, who helped the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And that's just one example. There were several other referenda on various local ballots that voters said, this is what we want. And yet they voted for the guy who doesn't want any of that. Can you explain this, Steve?
I think Trump was able to handle the abortion issue about as well as he could during the campaign and say, well, we turned it over to the states. Now, if you live in a state with this highly restrictive, that's not much comfort to you, but that was his line, and apparently it was successful. I think it's important. We're talking about, you know, what kind of country we are. I think it's important for the Democratic Party to think about what kind of party it is to have lost to this guy two of the last three elections, and in the third one by pretty convincing numbers. I think that the party needs to think about Why are we losing Latinos? Why are we losing, starting to lose Black men, white working class? There is a feeling that the Democratic Party has strayed pretty far from the old coalition, that, you know, the Clinton coalition that moved into the Obama coalition. And I think that's definitely part of it. They lost Candace, to these guys.
Candace, I think you mentioned a little while ago in this conversation that they had begun to lose African-Americans, and particularly African-American men, because they felt that they were, and we've heard this before, they felt they're only paid attention to at election time. They're taken for granted the rest of the time. What do the voters that are migrating away from Democrats, Latinos, African-Americans, other subsets of the culture, what do they want? What kind of attention do they want? What are they getting from the other party that makes them want to be there?
Well, let me just be really clear about a couple of things. One is that we have to recognize that Black voters, Latino voters, women voters are very diverse groups. So when we talk about women moving for Trump, we're talking about white women moving for Trump. When we talk about Latinos, we're talking about a very specific groups. So, and same for Black folks. Like, Black folks tend to overwhelmingly support Democrats, but there are these shifts. The second thing I want to bring up here is that among Black voters, we've actually seen for a decade an increasing number of Black people, especially younger Black people, vote for Democrats, but not identify with Democrats. And we've seen more and more identifying as kind of independents or nonpartisans, and they've wanted people and signaled over time that they wanted the Democratic Party to do more attention, pay more attention. Now,
what does that mean? What does that mean? What do they want?
I think it means that people want to see that candidates care about health disparities, about wealth disparities, about the everyday lives of, you know, criminal legal system and crime. I mean, there's both of those, right? And I'm not sure that people feel like the Democratic Party is working toward those issues, whether they're right or wrong. They don't feel that way.
Okay, well, we'll talk about a little bit more about that when we come back, and then we'll get into the North Carolina races that will make a difference in North Carolinians' lives after the vote yesterday around the state. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison from WFAE News, our political reporter. Candace Watt-Smith is a professor of political science at Duke University, and Susan Roberts, the same, at Davidson College. And we're talking about the outcome of the election. The economy, Susan, seemed to be a key factor in many voters' minds as they pulled the lever for Donald Trump as opposed to Kamala Harris. And a lot of coalitions that the Democrats, we've been talking about this, have depended on, not the whole coalition, but individuals within those coalitions have split off and gone toward the Republican Party because they are not a monolith. And it seems if you vote for the economy, despite all of the achievements of the Biden administration that seem to be unnoticed, ignored, or simply denied, or maybe haven't hit the pocketbook of individuals quite yet, They voted for their own self-interest. That's probably true in all elections, but have we lost a sense of the common good? Are we splintering, not just left and right, but into our little individualness factions?
I think there's a good case to be made for that. But if you look at the access to abortion question, we are not a monolith. And I think Trump was able to successfully waffle and walk back some things that he had said that were kind of unequivocal. Women need to be punished. And for most people, that they have mixed feelings about access to abortion. It's on a spectrum. It's not pro or con. It's on a spectrum. And I do think If you look at it, we have to really pull back and say, where was the gender question and the race question? Because clearly we had a woman of color that was on the ticket, and that didn't deliver.
And she downplayed. She never talked. She never talked about that. She downplayed that. She never talked about her gender. She never really talked about her race.
Would that have made a difference, though? I don't know. I mean, given that people can see that she's a woman, they can see that she's a woman of color. And should she have played that up more? I think if she had, we would be having the same conversation about why she failed to win, and attributing it to addressing more to identity politics.
Donald Trump did not play up his maleness nor his whiteness, but he certainly appealed and gives voice to and permission to white people and particularly men. The bro culture loves him. And you're completely apoplectic about this, Susan. So go ahead and get in there and tell me why I'm wrong.
I think he played up that bromance pretty starkly. I mean, he said, I will protect women whether they like it or not. And to me, that's about as sexist as you can get. That is so
old school. It didn't matter.
I know it didn't matter, but he did play up that. So, I guess I'm just thinking that's what I saw when I saw the Elon Musk and I saw really the macho. Many people were thinking about and attributed. I have no idea what machismo is. Well, I have some idea, but not exactly. They said that was one of the appeals for Donald Trump. It was that machismo to perhaps some of the Hispanic voters.
Well, there has been this discussion that white males in particular feel, young white males in particular feel abandoned. They don't know their role in society. It's been changed by the woke culture, to use other people's words. They don't know how to act. They don't know what the expectations are. And they've been given permission to be guys in public, locker room talk, which is what Trump and Vance did a lot on the campaign trail. Candace, what's in store for American culture going forward?
I don't know, but I don't think it's going to be good. I mean, the fact that we have folks, you know, telling racist jokes, that we have, prominent politicians calling other prominent politicians prostitutes and having pimps, and that none of this is being punished at the polls, and that people aren't speaking against it, I think speaks to the idea that we're moving into a new realm of what is acceptable and kind of from elites. I mean, the thing is that we want elites, we want our politicians to be just like us, but we also want them to be better than us. And that's
do
not
we?
What
do we? We used to, but do we now?
I don't think so. I think that what we're seeing is, you know, people will tell you who they are through their behavior. And voters have supported these behaviors.
I want to talk about the ceiling and the floor, but particularly the floor. And we'll do that by talking about the governor's race in North Carolina. Josh Stein beat Mark Robinson by about 55-39%.
Tonight, the people of North Carolina resoundingly embrace division. That's optimistic, forward-looking, and welcoming. A vision that's about creating opportunity for every North Carolinian. We chose hope over hate. Competence over chaos. Decency over division. That's who we are as North Carolinians.
Josh Stein last night declaring victory. Steve, are we schizophrenic? Everything he just said is the opposite of what happened in the national race.
Well, I mean, there you go. I mean, he's saying North Carolinians made the right choice when they voted for him. And I guess he would assume they made the wrong choice at the presidential level. But it's fascinating because, once again, things that Donald Trump is able to do and that don't impact him, when other candidates try it or walk down that road, it blows up in their face. It destroyed Mark. I mean, Mark Robinson's campaign, I think, was over even before the CNN report. And that just took it to a new bottom, like you said. I mean, I think he fell below 40%.
Well, yeah, but think about that. The last number that I saw was 55% Stein, 39% Robinson. This, after the allegations put forth by CNN, this after all the things that North Carolinians at least have heard over the years from Mark Robinson, it's on tape, it's on YouTube, it's on the, you can go watch it anytime you want to. So what this means is that nearly 40% of the population thought that Robinson's repugnant, racist, homophobic comments, including calling himself a Nazi and declaring that slavery wasn't so bad and that he, in fact, wouldn't mind owning one, 40% of North Carolinians believe that's okay. How do you explain that?
I wouldn't say they 40% believe it's okay. I imagine there was a segment that thought he was a bad guy and that it wasn't okay, but they were going to pull that he was, I'm going to assume they thought he was the lesser of two evils, that they did not want a Democrat in the governor's office. I doubt there were very, I mean, because there was a poll, the Elon poll showed that only 40% of Republicans believed his denials. I think a lot of people did not like Mark Robinson, of the people who voted for him, but went ahead and did it just because out of pure partisanship that they're going to support Republicans.
Here's how Robinson, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think some of what we're describing is what we call moral licensing, right? This kind of idea that you can say that you're all right in one area, even if you do something not so great in another. And so, hey, we didn't support Mark Robinson who said all of these things. And so that's why it's okay for us to vote for Trump for the economy. And I think that's what we've seen in the abortion question is, well, I can separate, you know, when the abortion is on the ballot, I can support abortion separate and apart from the candidates. And so it's there's a lot of cognitive dissonance here. And so some of what we're seeing, I think, in this kind of contradictions in behavior, vote splitting, even though we see the gubernatorial candidate for the GOP do very similar things as the presidential, you know, GOP candidate, people are trying to, I think, sleep with a good conscience.
Susan.
I just think Mark Robinson, I agree completely. Mark Robinson was such an outlier when it comes to a flawed candidate. I want to see a candidate. Show me a candidate that's more flawed than the one portrayed with the CNN allegations. He came from a position in which he did not have much responsibility, authority as lieutenant governor, and that's just the nature of the office. But I think if people compare, they were upset about Herschel Walker and some other candidates that might not have the kind of arsenal of agenda familiarity or really know a lot about government. This was, you know, I'm not surprised at 40% because 40% will vote partisan really no matter what. And I think that voters were really clear. How would you defend a vote for Mark Robinson? You can say I'm a Republican and I just don't like Josh Stein. He just didn't show me enough. And you can say, well, he's, you know, Robinson is, you know, going to fight back. But one of the things that happened in this election is there was a very effective use of words against candidates. And I think even though we have the Taylor Swift effect, they were saying this morning on the news that the Democrats, I mean, the Republicans ran that transgender ad over 30,000 times in many markets. And I think that speaks to a culture that's not really welcoming of the other. I think that Robinson was a national outlier of being so extreme and to say some of the things about not just women, but Nazis.
And yet, here's how Robinson characterized the race he lost last night.
You know, I'm standing here now, folks, and guess where my head is? My head is held high. And the reason why my head is held high is because I ran away a race where I did not have to lie. I did not have to tell half-truths. I did not have to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars demonizing anyone. I simply traveled this state and told people about my vision and told the people of North Carolina that I have an unabiding faith in them.
So the people chose Josh Stein to be the governor. We often have a habit of choosing Republican presidents in North Carolina, but Democratic governors. Steve, what can Josh Stein do? How will his administration be different from Roy Cooper's? And will he get anything done, given the fact that it looks like the legislature is largely Republican? I don't know if they maintained their supermajority, did they?
No, they did not. So Josh Stein now will start his term with a bit of power. The Republicans still hold a supermajority in the state Senate, but their Democrats were able to break it in the state House. So that's perhaps the biggest win of all for North Carolina Democrats in this election. And then they'll go into 2026 with Trump on the ballot. Maybe with a little more vigor from their voters and maybe try and claw back even more seats. But I don't think we should expect anything different from Stein in terms of policy. I mean, he even said that in interviews. He said, well, I can't really think of anything I would do different than Governor Cooper. But the main thing is he will have the veto again, assuming the Democratic coalition stays together.
Tricia Cotham, who gave the House and the General Assembly their supermajority by switching parties after the last election, is back. She beat her challenger, the Democrat Nicole Sidman. Was this basically, Steve, because of the way the districts have been drawn?
I mean, in part, the Republicans tried to draw Sidman, tried to draw Tricia Cotham the most advantageous district they could. The best they could do was a toss-up district. And in this election, when everything, almost all, through all parts of North Carolina, everything shifted a little bit to the right, that appears to be enough. But for Democrats, the bright side, they did flip a seat in North Mecklenburg. It was a Republican state House seat. Democrat Beth Helfrich, she won it.
And Democrat Mo Green beat Michelle Morrow for the job of state superintendent of public instruction. He beat her 51.1 to 48.9, at least according to the latest figures. She was really out there, yet he won. What does that tell us?
I think it says that she was also a very bad candidate, like Mark Robinson, that people did not. That message was not able to break through as much as it was for the lieutenant governor. But in the end, Democrats won, I believe, 5 council of state seats. They flipped the lieutenant governor's office. So there are some bright spots for this, for the North Carolina Democrats after last night.
Yeah, Rachel Hunt will be the next lieutenant governor. She's the Democrat and the daughter of Jim Hunt, a frequent guest in the governor's office. Democrat Jeff Jackson will be the state's next attorney general, having beaten Dan Bishop, the Republican. And this is how Jackson said he achieved that victory.
Being a basically reasonable person who actually cares about other people, I firmly believe that's the way forward. It isn't a slogan. It isn't a faction. It isn't outrage. It's simple, straightforward public service. That's how I plan to do this job. And I can't tell you how excited I am to get started.
He's very popular on TikTok. Was that the secret sauce, his notoriety, his well-knownness, if that's a word? Or is it the fact that he's a regular guy and portrayed himself that way? Susan, I only have a couple of seconds to make it quick. Go ahead.
Well, I think he said my opponent has never prosecuted a case. And I think for many people, that was all it took.
And yet, Kamala Harris said, I'm a prosecutor and I know how to deal with Donald Trump. And she was wrong. Only U.S. citizens can vote in federal elections, but some jurisdictions like Maryland, California, Vermont, even the District of Columbia, allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. And around the country, Republicans put forth initiatives to stop that in their locations. Here in North Carolina, there was a constitutional amendment that read only a citizen of the U.S. who is 18 years of age can vote. That was already the law. Steve, what difference will the fact that this passed by predominant numbers, what difference will it make in 30 seconds?
I don't think any difference in the short term. Like you said, Mike, the idea was in some places, local elections, people are letting non-citizens vote. That's just now explicitly against the law in North Carolina.
And a lot of the judges that we voted for yesterday are Republicans throughout the state of North Carolina. What's the state of the Democrat Allison Riggs and Republican Jefferson Griffin at the Supreme Court level? Quickly.
Allison Riggs is down by about 10,000 votes. If she loses, the Republicans have a 6-1 majority on the state
side. Steve Harrison from WFAE, Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Candace Watt-Smith from Duke University. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.